Hello, I'm Patricia Camilleri. Welcome to today's programme in this series entitled The Artifact. In these programmes, I shall be speaking to Malta's key archaeologists about archaeology in general and about the many fascinating projects that are in progress or planned for the future. My guest today is Ms. Katia Stroud. Katia studied archaeology at the University of Malta, graduating with a master's degree in 2004. Her studies have focused mainly on the history of conservation and management of archaeological sites, particularly the Maltese prehistoric temples. She worked in rescue archaeology for a number of years, together with a private group of freelance archaeologists, and has been employed with Heritage Malta since 2004. She's currently a curator within the World Heritage Sites Unit of Heritage Malta. Welcome, Katia.
Thank you.
I think our first introduction really was through the Malta Archaeological Review, which is the journal of the Archaeological Society Malta, which because I asked you to contribute a piece on the development of the sites of Hajar Aynu and Niger from an historical and archaeological perspective. So when I was arranging these programmes, I thought it'd be wonderful if you could come and speak to Campus FM listeners on the artifact. And I believe this was the subject of your MA dissertation.
Yes, right.
Right, so I think we ought to sort of start at the beginning, really, which is always a good place to start when you're recounting a narrative. Mm-hmm. Hajar Aynu and Niger temples, when were they discovered and who actually excavated them?
Yes, well, you can't really say they were discovered because we know parts of Hajar Aynu were always visible, in fact. Only parts of them were buried. And probably the fact that you had these massive blocks of stone jutting out in the landscape attracted curiosity towards this site. And in fact, it was excavated very early on in 1839. And it was the governor's initiative at the time who asked a certain J.G. Vance, we don't know exactly his first name, but and he was an officer of the Royal Engineers. And Officer Vance actually directed, you can't say it's the excavation of the site really, because at the time the archaeological technique of excavation wasn't really developed. It was more like the clearing of the site from soil and rubble and the collection of, well, the more pretty looking artifacts, let's put it that way, the decorated pottery and the figurines. In fact, we do have a collection of some 9 figurines which were collected by Officer Vance's excavations at the time. And following that, obviously, further excavations were carried out by other archaeologists. And this time they were more archaeologically correct in a way, taking care of the stratigraphy, the different layers and features that were being excavated. And amongst these were Professor Evans and Dr. Trump. And most of these excavations were to try and connect Hajar Aynu and Niger to the actual different phases that were being discovered and were being actually identified for Maltese prehistory. But the major excavation or the major clearance was actually in the 1800s, and unfortunately we lost a lot of information then.
Yes, this is the problem. You mentioned the fact that the first excavations weren't sort of very what we would call professional now.
Yes,
and
exactly.
That is always the danger with an archaeological site, that as soon as you touch it, as soon as you uncover it, then you are damaging it in a certain sense.
Well, yes. Actually, a lot of archaeologists explain excavations as a kind of a one-off experiment which you can't repeat, really, because it's a scientific technique. But if something goes wrong, you can't give it another go, sort of thing, because you've lost your information, really.
One thing, obviously, which we can't offer listeners is the visual element, because the photographs of the various excavations, in inverted commas, over the years, actually are really very, very interesting. One particular one comes to mind of men in top hats sitting on top of the some of the uprights.
Yes, exactly.
At Hajar Aeyum. I don't know where that particular one, whether you remember it.
Well, actually, we have different drawings which give us most of the information about these early excavations because, as I said, the technique of archaeological excavation wasn't developed yet. And so was the technique of recording excavations, unfortunately. So we don't have very good records or reports about these excavations. And we really depend a lot on the graphic information. And at the time, the 1800s, we have mainly sketches that the excavators made, such as, for example, in Vance's very short report, unfortunately, we have a lot of drawings of the site as it was after the excavation. Mm-hmm. But we do have a drawing of the facade of the site from the 1700s, which was drawn by Houel, Jean Houel, who was traveling the Mediterranean and visiting different historical sites at the time. So that shows us how the site was before Vance's excavations, basically. Mm-hmm. So this graphic documentation is extremely important to understand the changes that the site went through.
Sure, because we tend to sort of look at it today and love it as it is today.
Yes, of course.
Without really realizing that some of it is an invention, if you like, although obviously each archaeologist, each excavator has tried to create something that they thought was a probable picture of the site as in its original state.
Yes.
But what we see today, of course, is not.
Well, it's what we see today, even just looking at the facade. In fact, if anyone goes on site today, there is actually an information panel showing you this drawing of the facade of Hajar Aeyum by Houel. And you can actually compare and contrast what the drawing shows and what you actually see on site today. And it's a very different picture. And yes, throughout the different excavations, which were very often followed by restoration and conservation interventions, there were slight changes made to the site, obviously in attempts to recreate what it was in the past. Obviously, these are very small changes to the site. I'm sure the site was extremely different in its heyday in prehistory. But yes, it did go through a lot of changes because of these interventions.
You say that the site, not unlike Tarshin, for example, was not actually buried underneath the ground as Tarshin was and discovered in the early 1900s. Has the fact that they were not buried, has that affected the preservation of the site?
Yes. Well, parts of the megaliths, the larger megaliths, were always exposed to the elements. And yes, in fact, today you can see that they are very deteriorated. But then the major part of the site was actually buried. And this sudden exposure then through excavation, and which led to actually uncovering all the surfaces and making them exposed to the elements, that is a kind of shock, actually, to the stone material. And in fact, once you uncover a stone and expose it to the elements, such as, for example, you have rainfall and changes in temperature and changes in humidity of the stone, because when as soon as rain falls, you have the stone absorbing the water, and then obviously the sun comes out and you have this drying process, and the continuous cycle of wetting and drying actually weakens the stone, especially then with the effect of salts within the stone. And also in the case of Hajar Aeyum and the Nidra, they have an additional problem in a way because of their location, because they're so close to the sea. And you get the aerosols from the sea, the salts in the air, which additionally contribute to the deterioration of the stone. And, well, all these elements were not affecting it when it was buried in fact. So the sudden exposure of the stone has in fact weakened it mm-hmm. in a way. Mm-hmm. And that is why this is our major concern at the moment for the preservation of these sites.
Mm-hmm. There are some pieces, the smaller pieces, that as in Taishan, the originals were copied and the original were taken to the National Museum of Archaeology.
Yes.
And
uh-huh.
what you see are replicas. I mean, the Tree of Life, well, what's referred to
what's
the Tree
referred
of Life pillar
to us.
at Hajjaim is not obviously the one you see in situ. Is not
no,
the original.
Exactly.
So some preservation was done in that way, but of course, not for the larger. Stone.
Actually, that was one of the more successful interventions, in fact, because these elements, which were portable elements in a way, were transported indoors where they are completely protected from this wetting and drying cycles, for example, or they're not exposed to all these salts in the air or from the ground. And in fact, they're in a very good state of preservation at the museum. The only thing that wasn't done in the past, but now we've rectified, is that the copies on site weren't marked as copies. So a lot of visitors who didn't read up before visiting the site wouldn't know that those were copies and would think they were the original. But now, in fact, we've put in information panels saying, listen, these are copies of the originals. But even there were other steps taken to try and preserve a lot of elements within the site.
Before we continue talking about the preservation of the site, I'd just like to remind those listeners who might only just have joined us that this is The Artifact, and I'm Patricia Camilleri, and I'm talking to Katia Stroud, who's a curator within the World Heritage Sites Unit of Heritage Malta, and we're discussing the sites, the development, the preservation of Hajjaim and of Nidra.
Yes.
We were mentioning the preservation.
Yes, yes. I was saying, mentioning the different steps that were taken throughout the years to preserve these sites. For example, one intervention was, actually, it was a very common intervention. One type of intervention was the use of cement to repair certain megaliths, for example, that had developed cracks or little breaks in them. Today we know that cement causes more damage to the stones because of the salt content again in them, and because cement is so much stronger than limestone, that once you have these cycles of, for example, thermal changes within the stone and the movement within the stone, it's likely that the megalith would crack in another place, since the cement is so strong and resists that thermal movement within the megalith. But at the time, for example, one intervention that was carried out was in the 1920s, well, early 1920s, where a lot of cement was used. But at the time, internationally, cement and concrete even was recognized as the material to be used in restoring archaeological sites and historical sites. So, you know, considering with hindsight, you think, oh dear, why did they use cement? But at the time, it was, you know, the best material to be used. So at the time, the curators and the archaeologists taking care of the site were making great effort to use the best possible measures
to preserve them.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, exactly. Mm-hmm. Other interventions, for example, which we can still see today, and in fact were a bit more sensitive, let's put it that way, to the site, are, for example, restoration of certain walls that were done in rubble wall, in fact. And it's quite an interesting approach, actually, because some parts of the buildings themselves were reconstructed using small rubble stones. And today you can automatically visually identify which areas were reconstructed and which areas are original. So that makes them, you know, very readable to any visitor. You can notice straight away which is the original. And at the same time, they were using materials which are the same as the site, so they're compatible materials, unlike cement, for example. And apart from that, they were using a technique that was very common at the time. You had a lot of farmers in the area who knew this technique very well because they were using it for their own rubble walls in their fields. And therefore you had, an available workforce sort of thing to build these walls and also maintain them, in fact. You didn't need to train new people
for it. No, you had the know-how.
Exactly.
The know-how was there. And at the moment, given the fact that there have been these past preservation efforts, at the moment, are the preservation efforts being continued in the sense of actual preservation of the stone, or are they only external preservation issues such as the wooden flooring and that sort of thing?
Yes, yes. Well, at the moment, what is being done, actually, not just for Hajar Imam and Umnaidra, but for all the temple sites, in fact, the World Heritage Sites Unit, together with a number of consultants, are drafting a conservation plan for all these sites. And unfortunately, well, looking back over the past few years, you realize that a lot of interventions on these sites were reactive in a way where you had, certain collapses, for example, in parts of the sites, which were caused by heavy rainstorms, etc. And the major interventions that were carried out on these sites, especially at Hajar Imam and Umnaidra, were a reaction to that.
Crisis management rather than planned.
Mm-hmm. In a way, it was, trying to fix a problem that has cropped up and that's it. So we now are lucky enough that no such major collapses have occurred. And we're stepping back in a way and looking at the sites again and actually examining where the problems lie. And we're in fact putting together a whole catalogue of different problems on each and every temple site, in fact. And after that, we'd like to look at each problem and find out solutions which are obviously compatible to the site and ethically compatible with international standards and charters for intervention on such sites. And in that way, we would like to identify weak areas within the sites to avoid such interventions as, trying to reconstruct a collapse that has occurred. We'd like to intervene before it actually occurs, sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So that is what's going on at the moment. And then for Hajar Imam and Umnaidra in particular, there's a major intervention which will be taking place very soon, possibly sometime next year, in fact, where the two sites will be sheltered, in fact. This shelter will be basically a roofing structure. The sides will be open. So, and the shelter itself would be, in a way, like a tent structure. Mm. It's very, a very light structure, although it will be quite large to cover such a massive building, such as Hajar Imam or Umnaidra. And the idea for this structure is to protect the sites from elements such as rainfall and to limit, for example, what I mentioned before, the thermal change within the stone, which contributes to its deterioration. It should limit that thermal change by protecting it from direct sunlight, for example. And the idea for it really is to be a temporary measure. In fact, we don't envisage to have these sites sheltered forever. But we'd like to gain some time, in a way, to protect them. But at the same time, gain some time in the sense for studying different possibilities for intervention and trying to find new solutions for preserving them, in fact. And as I mentioned before, the fact that these sites were, or parts of them were buried, had preserved them for a long time. And their exposure increased their rate of deterioration, in fact. So in a way, we want to step back to that, not by burying the sites, obviously, we want them to be visible, but by protecting them in a different way.
This is always the conundrum, really. when I was talking to Dr. Timigambi, the maritime archaeologist, yes. He was saying, well, you know, certain things really for the moment can remain under the water because that's the best place for them.
Yes, you know, exactly.
It's an archaeologist conundrum. Are we going to excavate? Are we going to expose? Are we going to expose to tourism, for example, or tourists walking in and out? And certain decisions have to be made and things have to be put in the balance. Commercial interests, of course, aesthetic interests, archaeological interests, everything has to be sort of thought about and planned for. And sometimes, in certain circumstances, we're still in time not to do anything, which sounds like a paradox, but...
Yes, in a way, and especially for new excavations, in fact, it's definitely something that archaeologists have now started to think about, and thinking of the long-term future of their site and what should be done. And in fact, I believe a lot of sites are being left buried to protect them. But in the case of the more megalithic temples, you obviously can't go back and bury them, especially because they are now such, not just for commercial reasons, but they are now such an integral part of even our identity.
Yes,
you know, when you think of Malta,
cultural
you really
markers,
think
really, yes.
Exactly, and you think of what really makes us particular, what makes us special. The megalithic temples are there. It's one of the reasons why Malta is a special destination, for example. And even nationally, as an identity, they are definitely an integral part of our identity.
Sure. An interesting thing, which you do mention, actually, in your article, and I've also heard Professor Torpiano speak about, is the collapse. Sad, of course, though it was. Was also had a good side to it in the sense that you could actually see how things were done, either originally or in secondary interventions in recent years.
Yes. Well, this is just as when you in medicine, actually. When you dissect something, and you can see behind its cover. And in the operation to restore the temples, yes, we do get chances in a way to look beyond the surface and to get into the technical aspect of temple building. Mm-hmm. And, in fact, even today, it's the brighter side of deterioration, I guess. But even today, there are certain areas which are deteriorating, which have exposed, for example, the infill, which is the material between the outer and the inner walls of the temple chambers, and the way that was actually built. We used to think that this material used to be dumped in there just to fill in this empty gap, but actually it was constructed very carefully. And because of the deterioration of some blocks, we can actually see it now. So that's the brighter side. Obviously, it's a pity that we're losing so much material.
Yes.
But it does give you a lot more information about the construction. And, you know, getting to know more about the construction techniques that these people used adds to the value of the site in a way. So we're not just losing from these sites, we're also gaining information, which is, you know, the brighter aspect of it.
One thing which amused me once with I was at a seminar about on this issue of the earlier collapse at Niger. Professor Torpiano mentioned that when they were trying to put the block back, he got one of these mechanical pulleys to pull it up, and they had to use special straps so that it wouldn't damage the stone. And the mechanical apparatus actually jammed because it found that the stone was too heavy for it. And, you know,
exactly.
It sort of does, it really sort of makes one wonder, really, how on earth with the technology that they had at the time,
yes, exactly,
how they managed to build that kind of structure.
I always believe that we've been kind of spoiled in a way, because we have all this mechanical stuff and all this technology to help us along. So in a way, our brain stops there and we don't think, okay, how can we get around this? Because we have the technology to do it. Sure. But yes, at the time, they actually had a lot of problem solving because they didn't have these machines and they had to work with stone, animals, people, and maybe some wooden trunks or something.
Exactly. And various other things. Whatever. Which we can see on the side.
Uh-huh, exactly. Mm-hmm. So they were very clever in getting around these problems, in fact. So
we've got the sites which are going to be covered now. That's been decided. What about the long-term preservation possibilities for the site? Are our children's children and their children going to be able to see these sites in the future?
Yes, well, let's hope so, and let's hope it would be without shelters on them as well. But yes, well, the future for these sites, apart from the fact that we're going to have a visitor centre as well, constructed for Hajar Imandum Naidra, which will help definitely in the interpretation of these sites, because at the moment all we have are information panels on sites. But apart from that, there's a lot of research to be taken in hand, basically. And in fact, these shelters are definitely going to help us preserve these sites for our children's children, etc.
Great. Well, as usual, we've run out of time. This is the end of today's programme. I'd like to thank Katja Stroud for being with us and for talking to us about the history and the development of Hajar Imandum Naidra, two remarkable megalithic sites in Malta. Until next time we meet, this is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.